Have you ever tried really, really hard to learn something? Maybe a new skill or a language?
Oh, definitely.
And no matter how much effort you put in, it wouldn't stick.
Yeah.
You know, you had the books, the drive.
Yeah, like your brain just wasn't letting it in. It's super frustrating.
It really is. And you wonder, is it the subject or is it something else?
That feeling that pushing against like an invisible wall.
Yeah.
It's so common, it makes you question what learning or even just being affected by things really takes.
And that's exactly what we're diving into today. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Uh-huh.
We're going to unpack a really core concept from Chapter 13 of Unraveling the Fabric of Fear. It introduces something called the Law of Permission. We'll pull in bits from those earlier chapters where it makes sense, just for context.
Yeah, helps tie it all together.
Our mission really is to unpack this whole concept of permission, how our attention, our curiosity basically grants it.
Okay, so the starting point, the fundamental idea in the chapter, is that attention signals, well, it signals a willingness to be curious.
And by being curious, we're basically saying, okay, come on in to communication, to information.
Right. And the only real way to revoke that, to say, nope, not interested, is to just pull back your attention, withdraw it. The analogies it uses are pretty helpful, too.
Like the dog analogy.
Paying attention to a dog signals you're open to interacting. Turning away, that's a clear signal. Nope, not interested. Denying permission for more engagement.
The chapter uses this this example of someone telling a joke. It's pretty relatable.
Mm-hmm. If you pay attention, you're listening, you're sort of implicitly giving them permission to, well, try and be funny.
Yeah, you're giving them the floor, so to speak. But what if maybe you know this person and their jokes?
Mm-hmm.
But let's just say they don't usually land.
Right. So maybe you instinctively start thinking about something else. You tune out.
What's the message there, even if it's unspoken?
Well, the chapter suggests it could be, maybe subconsciously, that you just don't expect anything valuable from what they're about to say. It could even make the speaker feel a bit, you know, socially disconnected in that moment.
Yeah, like their attempts wasn't even worth focusing on.
Zero attention, the source presents that as signaling you're inconsequential. Like, you don't even matter enough to get a reaction, good or bad. Harassment is awful, obviously, negative attention, but it still acknowledges you exist. Someone is putting energy towards you, confirming you're significant enough for them to bother with.
Even if it's hateful energy.
Right.
So even negative attention acknowledges the attempt, maybe more respectfully than just being completely ignored.
Exactly. Being ignored can feel like you're invisible.
Wow. That really highlights the power of attention itself as a form of permission or validation.
Yeah.
Or just acknowledging someone's there.
It's potent stuff. And that leads to another point the chapter makes about positive attention.
The importance of it, yeah.
Definitely. When people, and the chapter interestingly mentions pets too, don't get enough constructive, positive attention, they might actually start acting out.
Doing things we see as disruptive or disharmonious.
Mm-hmm. Just to get some kind of reaction. Any attention, even negative attention.
It makes you think about that saying, any attention is good attention. It sounds wrong, but psychologically.
You can sort of see the logic, can't you? If positive connection isn't there, the drive is just to be acknowledged somehow.
Okay, so this law of permission idea, how does it connect directly to learning? Because that seems huge.
Oh, absolutely central. The chapter basically says we learn best what we're curious about. It's like our brain gives an automatic green light to stuff that sparks our interest.
And that curiosity isn't fixed, right? It moves.
Exactly. As you learn one thing, it naturally leads to related interests. You follow these connections.
So if a topic feels boring, it's because it doesn't seem relevant to what you're already curious about?
That's the idea. It's hard to absorb information when it feels disconnected. It's like the information doesn't have that permission slip signed by your curiosity.
Until maybe you find a connection or relevance emerges, and then the curiosity kicks in.
Precisely.
The source uses that classic example, you know, the student who finds geography just dull, names, places, whatever.
Right. Totally boring until.
Until maybe it connects to, I don't know, their favorite video game map or a historical thing they love.
And boom, suddenly geography isn't a chore anymore. Their curiosity grants it.
And then they start absorbing it almost without trying.
And this sheds light on why forced learning can be so ineffective, even counterproductive.
Right, trying to cram information into someone who just isn't curious about it.
Yeah, it often backfires. It can create these negative feelings, boredom, frustration, even dislike towards the subject itself, or maybe the classroom, or even the teacher trying to force it.
You can see how that might explain why quite a few people end up disliking school, as the chapter suggests.
Mm-hmm. There's that research mentioned, I think in Source 1, showing kids start out super curious.
Oh yeah, asking why, constantly.
But then the questioning just drops off a cliff in school.
Hmm.
And then there's the whole thing about faking curiosity.
Oh yeah, we've all done that, right? Nodding along in a meeting or conversation.
Pretending to be fascinated, maybe just to get social points or not seem rude.
And sometimes, maybe rarely, that feigned interest can spark something real.
It can happen. But the chapter argues it often just wastes time and mental energy, and it kind of creates false expectations, both for others and maybe even for ourselves, about what we're genuinely interested in.
So pulling this together, if you want to share information effectively, what's the absolute first step according to this law of permission?
Inspire curiosity. Yeah. You have to get that spark going first. Without it, the information just bounces off. It doesn't have permission to land, to be remembered.
But if you do have someone's curiosity,
then you inherently have their attention and you have their permission to share. It flows naturally from that curiosity.
This really makes you look at things like marketing or political messaging in a different light. They seem like experts at grabbing curiosity, don't they?
They absolutely are. The chapter points out how propaganda is often specifically engineered to capture attention, to trigger curiosity, precisely so the intended message gets absorbed.
And it mentions this interesting link or spectrum between curiosity and fear.
Yeah, they both operate on that same axis of attention, which makes fear a really potent tool for, well, the chapter calls it hijacking our curiosity.
Hijacking curiosity. How does that work?
Think about advertising. So much of it plays on fear, doesn't it? Fear of missing out, fear of not fitting in, fear of losing social status.
Right, they create that little bit of anxiety, that unease.
Exactly. They spark your curiosity about how to avoid that negative feeling, how to solve the problem they just highlighted, and then conveniently,
they offer their product or their idea as the solution.
Precisely. It's a way to grab your attention through fear-induced curiosity, and boom, they have permission to implant their message.
Wow. Okay, and the chapter also brings up emotional energy itself as a type of information.
Mm-hmm. Often subconscious, but still information.
And like other info, it needs our attention to be received.
Yes. You have to be, in a sense, open to feeling it, even if you're not consciously analyzing it.
So how does permission work with receiving, say, frustration? That seems like an emotion we don't want to give permission to.
Well, the chapter offers a really interesting take. It suggests frustration often arises because we're giving our attention, our focus, to unrealistic expectations.
Ah, okay. So we're locked onto what we think should happen instead of what is happening or what's realistically possible.
Exactly. And by focusing on those unrealistic expectations and maybe rejecting the realistic ones, we are, in effect, permitting frustration to come in and take hold.
And if we feel stuck in that frustration, like we can't withdraw our attention even though we want to.
The chapter suggests that can lead down difficult paths. Maybe trying to regain control through destructive means it mentions violence as an extreme, or developing a kind of resigned acceptance, which could become a traumatic acceptance over time.
That's heavy. What about the idea of identifying as a victim? How does permission play into that?
The chapter proposes that often adopting a victim identity requires our permission, consciously or not.
How so?
By consistently focusing our attention on a feeling or perception of powerlessness, of lacking control, we kind of allow ourselves to step into and embody that victim role.
But surely sometimes things happen that are outside our control.
Oh, absolutely. External events can definitely be uncontrollable. But the chapter's point is that our response to those events nearly always has some element of choice, some degree of agency. So complete absolute powerlessness and therefore a totally forced victimhood is argued to be quite rare.
Okay, that leads to another subtle point the chapter makes about receiving emotional energy from other people.
Mm-hmm. It compares it to, like, automatically clicking agree on those long online terms and conditions.
The ones nobody reads.
Yeah, right. We often subconsciously just let others influence our emotional state.
How do we do that?
Usually by focusing our attention on their story, the emotional effect they're expressing, rather than digging deeper into the underlying reasons, the cause behind their feelings. And the chapter notes that this kind of emotional energy transfer tends to be more subconscious than, say, deliberately learning factual information.
And this vulnerability, this subconscious permission granting.
Mm.
That's where manipulation through fear really comes in again, isn't it?
Absolutely. When we let our attention get snagged by the fears someone else is trying to provoke in us, especially if they're offering a neat solution alongside it, like in advertising or propaganda,
we're basically giving them permission to condition us, to steer us according to their agenda.
Mm-hmm. We've opened the door by focusing on the fear they presented.
So the crucial question then is, how do we get back in the driver's seat? How do we reclaim that permission?
Well, the chapter suggests a conscious strategy. First, practice recognizing when someone is trying to use fear to influence you. Identify that intended emotional effect.
Become aware of the tactic itself.
Exactly. And once you see the tactic, then you can consciously shift your focus. Try to figure out the cause. What fears might be driving their agenda? Why are they trying to make you feel this way?
Looking behind their curtain, essentially.
Sort of. By understanding their potential motives, the cause, you're in a much better position to decide consciously whether or not you want to grant permission for that fear to actually influence you. You regain your agency.
Now, the chapter also briefly touches on some religious or spiritual perspectives towards the end.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating how different traditions seem to echo this principle, often from centuries ago.
Like in Christianity, passages in Matthew talk about private reflection, asking, seeking, knocking.
Which sounds a lot like directing your attention, being actively curious and expecting to find something right, granting permission for insight.
Yeah. And Islam, the Quran, mentioning a reward for those who seek knowledge and understanding, again, linking that, seeking that curiosity and attention with gaining something valuable.
And Buddhist thought, like the Dhammapada saying, the mind is everything. What you think, you become. That's a very direct statement about the power of focus, of attention, shaping reality, very much in line with the law of permission.
Hinduism, too, the Bhagavad Gita, talking about the clarity of a focused mind and sharing wisdom with those who want to listen.
Implying their attention, their curiosity, their permission is necessary for the sharing to be effective.
And then other traditions mentioned, like the Tao Te Ching or the Law of One, they talk about aligning with wisdom through knowing and how ignorance limits opportunity.
Again, suggesting that focused attention, that curiosity is the pathway. It grants permission for wisdom and opportunity to arise.
It's really striking, isn't it, how these diverse ancient perspectives all seem to converge on this core idea.
Mm-hmm. That our focused attention, our natural curiosity, isn't just passive, it's the active key. It unlocks knowledge, shapes our experience. It's like humanity has intuitively known for a very long time just how powerful directing our mental energy really is.
And think back to our earlier discussions. Remember chapter one, talking about a culture maybe steeped in fear?
Mm-hmm. You can see how such a culture might have a strong incentive to control where people put their attention.
In chapter two, on victimhood, realizing that identifying as a victim often means giving attention to that feeling of powerlessness.
That's the first step to withdrawing that permission, isn't it? Breaking out of blame cycles.
In chapter five, on control and possession.
Mm-hmm. The source suggested genuine connection doesn't mean owning someone. Trying to control another person kind of bypasses their permission to just be.
So shifting your attention away from needing to control
helps withdraw the permission you might have given to negative stuff like envy or jealousy, which often come with that feeling of possessiveness.
What about labels from chapter 9?
Same idea. Accepting a negative label someone throws at you is essentially granting it permission to define you.
Or chapter 11, on how subjective justice is. Different definitions of right and wrong could be used very strategically to guide attention towards certain stories and, crucially, away from others.
Definitely. And chapter 12, on connection. This law of permission helps explain why that deep need for connection can sometimes make us vulnerable. Why we might seek out any attention, even negative, if positive connection feels scarce, we're granting permission out of that need.
Right. So let's bring this back to you, listening right now.
Mm-hmm.
Why does understanding this law of permission actually matter day to day?
Well, it gives you a framework, doesn't it? A way to understand how you're being influenced, both by information trying to get in and by all the emotional energy swirling around you.
It highlights that you have this tool.
Your attention. It's like a gatekeeper.
And by consciously choosing where you point that attention,
you're actively choosing what you permit to shape your thoughts and your feelings.
So here's something to maybe mull over. Given how powerful your attention is, how much it grants permission, how consciously, how deliberately are you choosing what you allow into your mind and your emotional space each day?
Yeah, how might this understanding change how you approach your own learning or your interactions or even just how you process the world around you? Something definitely worth thinking about.
Stay curious, stay focused on what you wish to permit. We hope that includes the next chapter. See you there.